So we are getting near the end of our Exodus study. We've been going through Exodus for about a year, seeing a lot of different aspects. And we're getting towards the end, we start to take larger chunks in a row, partially because the book of Exodus ends with a whole bunch of laws and rules and buildings and all those kinds of things. Today, we're going to continue a little bit on what we did last week. So I know that I try often not to link them so closely that if you missed last week, it's difficult to follow along. This is going to be a little bit closer to that today. So before we get started, I do want to recap where we were last week a little bit. If you weren't here last week, we looked at the story of the golden calf, which is one of the more popular ones. Even if you aren't super familiar with the Bible, that might be a story you're familiar with. And we looked at that story, hopefully, through a lens that maybe you haven't before. We said a few things that will play in today. Is one of the things that often gets misunderstood about that story is that when the Israelites build a golden calf, for many of us, we were taught that they're building an idol to a different god. They've left the god that brought them out of Egypt and now are going to be worshiping other gods. That's not true, though. If you go look through the story, what you see is that the Israelites actually build a calf that's supposed to represent the god they understand, Yahweh God, right? So what we said about that is when we looked at that story, we realized that what Israel was doing is that they were earnestly trying to follow God in the way that they knew how. Their context had been Egypt. That's all they knew. They'd been 400 years in Egypt as slaves, and so the way that they got to observe how people worshiped was by watching the Egyptians. And as many of you know, that if you were looking at the Egyptians and how they worshiped their God, building things was kind of their thing, right? We have a lot of things left over, massive monuments, like the pyramids or like Abu Simbel or any of those kinds of things where we have these gigantic temples built to worship their gods. And so how the story goes is that Moses gets sent to the top of the mountain. He's gone for a long time, and Israel starts to get worried, right? That what happened to Moses? Did he die? Did God kill him? Is God angry? We better serve him somehow. How do we do that? Well, let's build an idol, and we can focus on that. So they weren't following a different God. They were earnestly trying to follow the God they knew, but they did it wrong. And there were consequences for that. That created turmoil, created a lot of difficult things. The point that we made last week is that is a rhythm or a habit that we humans fall into often. So the progression we went through quickly was about 1,000 years after the golden calf is the New Testament. And in the New Testament, you have a group of people known as the Pharisees, who had read the Old Testament and realized that Israel had gone into exile because they failed to follow the law the right way. So that's what it says at the end of the Old Testament. Hey, you didn't follow the law, therefore you're going to exile. Israel comes back to the land, and the Pharisees say, we won't let that happen again. And so the Pharisees are earnestly trying to make sure they don't make the same mistake that happened in the Old Testament where they failed to follow the law the right way. And so they follow the law with an extreme rigidity, where every single thing that they did was trying to perfectly and exactly follow the law. But if you're familiar with the New Testament, you realize that in that earnest desire to follow God, they missed the point entirely. And often Jesus comes into confrontation with them and says, woe to you Pharisees, for you travel all the way across the world to make a convert and only to turn them into twice the child of hell that you are. Woo! Even though they were earnestly trying to follow God, they've lost the heart of the message behind the law and screwed it up entirely. We then fast-forwarded another 1,000 years, and when we get to the Crusades, a group of people who have seen the Holy Land fall, and for many of them are trying to earnestly follow God to get it back. But any historical study of the Crusades doesn't take long before you see the atrocities that happened during that. Even though many of them believed they were fighting on behalf of God, the destruction, chaos, pain that happens as a result because they didn't find the heart of God was massive. And so we closed last week by saying, you fast forward 1,000 years from the Crusades and it equals today. And so we asked ourselves the question last week, many of us being here might earnestly be trying to follow God, but are we missing it? In a similar way to the golden calf, to the Pharisees, to the Crusaders, The challenge was just to evaluate what we believe about things and how we're trying to serve God, and does it actually match the heart of God? Now, I do realize, because I had conversations with a number of you last week, that there was some confusion on what I might have meant by some of those things. I was going to actually talk about some of that confusion, but I think I'm not going to. If you have questions about what I was trying to say or if I said something wrong, just have a conversation with me. I'd be more than happy to. I don't want to add to the confusion, and I think it might. So like we said, Moses is on the mountain. Israel is scared because he's gone for a long time, so they try to worship God by making an idol. We saw that throughout history, we've done the same thing. So our challenge was to take an honest look at what we believe and ask ourselves, are we like Israel, earnestly seeking to follow Jesus, but are we actually doing it, or have we missed the point? Now, I did say, and I mean it, that there are parts of the American church right now that I believe don't look anything like Jesus. Places in the church where it looks a lot more like hatred or a desire to hold on to power than it is to care for the poor and the marginalized. Places where the church is dividing rather than leading the conversations that lead to unity. Places where people might earnestly be seeking to follow Jesus but forgot to love their neighbors as themselves. And I mean that. And that's going to matter a little bit today. It's also why it's so important for us as Jesus followers to regularly audit what we believe. How are we living it out? We're asking ourselves, is this that we're following what Jesus taught? Is what I'm doing or what I'm teaching match the heartbeat of God or who he is? Or has it become something else? It's so important for us to do this regularly because the consequences of not are severe. We see throughout the scripture that God takes that very seriously, both in the Old Testament and in the New. And we can see that we've seen throughout history the damage it's done when we don't do it well. So, with all of that in mind, that's where we pick up our story today. So we're going to be in Exodus 33 today, the chapter after the golden calf. But I do need to set the stage a little bit more before we start reading. Like I said, last week we saw that Moses was on the top of the mountain talking with God when Aaron builds the calf. And it's in that interaction where God says this, Exodus 32:9. "I have seen these people," the Lord said to Moses, "and they are a stiff-necked people. Now leave them alone so that my anger might burn against them and that I may destroy them. Then I will make you, Moses, into a great nation." But Moses sought the favor of the Lord, his God. "Lord," he said, "why should your anger burn against your people whom you brought out of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians say it was with evil intent that he brought them out to kill them in the mountains and wipe them off the face of the earth? Turn from your fierce anger, relent, and do not bring disaster on your people. Remember your servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, whom you swore by your own self. I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky, and I will give your descendants all this land I promised them. And I will be their it will be their inheritance forever." Then the Lord relented and did not bring his people the disaster he had threatened. We read that last week, and I do understand that I said this last week as well. There is a lot to unpack in that passage, some of which could be really difficult for us. We're not going to completely resolve that today. I'm sorry, but if it is something that's still troubling for you, let's grab coffee and talk about it. There's some things that we do need to wrestle with, and they're difficult. But last week we looked at this passage and said generally that this shows that God takes Israel's miss pretty seriously. That's still true. But I want to focus on a different part for this morning. What we see here is that God comes to Moses and makes him an offer that we can read over quickly. So the people have built the golden calf, they're worshiping it, God's angry, and then God says to Moses, "Moses, I will make you into a great nation." Now, we can read over that really quickly because of it's one line, and then we have a whole bunch more after it. But I do want to camp there for a little bit and just recognize that that's not a small offer. It's actually a pretty monstrous one. It's huge. Because what do we know? We know that by this time in Exodus, Moses is pretty frustrated with Israel too, right? He's already had issues with them. He's already struggled with them. He's already been frustrated with them, angry with them. There's a story, remember, when there were so many complaints that he's like, "I can't even handle this." And then his father-in-law says, "I knew you're going to have to get judges to help work out some of these disputes." Moses has already built a frustration towards Israel too. And so now, where we're at is they haven't been the easiest to lead. And God is essentially saying to Moses, that can all be over. All of the frustration that you've had with all of these people can just be done. We're going to start over, and you can be the founder of the great nation. You and your boys. God's saying that these people, they're stiff-necked, they're extremely hard to work with, so let's just start over. And Moses, you then get to be the greatest. If you lay that out, you realize that's a pretty tempting offer, isn't it? If you were put in that position, it'd be a pretty tempting offer, wouldn't it be? Because how much easier is it to just start something new than to fix something that's broken? It's a lot easier, isn't it? Especially when you're working with people. It's one thing if you're going to fix a machine or something that doesn't have opinions or talk back. It's another thing when you're trying to adjust or change or move a group of people, all with ideas, passions, all of those kinds of things. It's not easy. And anybody who's been in the church long enough knows that if you add religion to it, it only gets a lot harder, right? How easy is it to change a church? Not. That's the answer, in case you didn't know. Right? It's a reason that churches tend to be stuck in their ways. I remember when I was a kid, they called them the worship wars because we had to argue about whether you could use a guitar in church or not, right? And there were some people who were adamant, absolutely not. That's the devil's instrument, apparently. I don't know. Or drums or something like that, right? It's really difficult to move people. And so the offer is you don't have to move these people at all. We'll get rid of them and start over, and you can be the greatest. That's a huge offer. It would be much easier for Moses to just accept that offer. And yet, Moses says, God, you can't do that. Why? Because I know who you are. God, you can't do that because I know the promises you made to Abraham. You know, God, you can't do that because you know what you were trying to accomplish in Egypt. That all goes away if you wipe out these people. Because you were trying to prove to Egypt that you were more powerful and more caring and different from all of their gods. If you then bring them out into the wilderness and destroy them, Egypt's going to go, he didn't care. He just brought them out there so he could kill them. Everything you tried to accomplish in Egypt would be gone. Moses appeals to God's character. Moses appeals to who he knows God to be and says, we can't take that path because of that. Now, I know that's confusing. And here, at this point, here as a reader, you have a decision to make, which is often true with passages like this. You have to decide who this interaction is for. Does God actually need to be reminded of his promises? Does he need to be convinced by Moses not to wipe out his people? You can read that in this story, and I'm not saying that sarcastically either. There are a bunch of people who've studied it, and that is the conclusion they come to. But there is another option. Does God need to be convinced? Does he need to be reminded of who he is or the promises he makes? Or is this interaction not for God, but instead for Moses? Does Moses need to remember who God is, what his promises are? Does Moses need to see that leaning into God's promises shows his faithfulness? That even though from one perspective it would be easier for him to just start over with his own line, he had to realize that wasn't the best thing because that changes his relationship with God and who he believes God to be. That's a choice that you have to make. Huge props for Moses to seeing that it's better to not wipe them out either way, because clearly that offer is tempting. Moses says to God, you can't do that. God relents. He listens to Moses and doesn't. So Moses heads down the mountain, and the rage that he had just advocated for God to withhold, he feels himself. He's mad. He smashes the tablets. He grinds up the calves. He makes the people drink it and orders the Levites to kill 3,000. I know that's tough, too. We can talk about that over coffee if you want as well. And then we pick the story back up in Exodus 33. It says, the Lord then said to Moses, leave this place, you and the people you brought up out of Egypt, and go to the land that I promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, I will give it to your descendants. I will send an angel before you to drive out the Canaanites, Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. Go up to the land flowing with milk and honey, but I will not go with you, because you are a stiff-necked people, and I might destroy you on the way. When the people heard these distressing words, they began to mourn, and no one put on any ornaments. For the Lord had said to Moses, tell the Israelites, you are a stiff-necked people. If I were to go with you, even for a moment, I might destroy you. Now take off your ornaments, and I will decide what to do with you. So the Israelites stripped off their ornaments at Mount Horeb. Now Moses used to take a tent and pitch it outside the camp, some distance away, calling it the tent of meeting. Anyone inquiring of the Lord would go to the tent of meeting outside the camp. And whenever Moses went out to the tent, all the people rose and stood at the entrances to their tents, watching Moses until he entered the tent. As Moses went into the tent, a pillar of cloud would come down and stay at the entrance while the Lord spoke with Moses. Whenever the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the entrance to the tent, they stood and worshipped at the entrances of their tents. The Lord would speak to Moses face to face as one speaks to a friend. Then Moses would return to the camp, but his young aide Joshua, son of Nun, did not leave the tent. Moses said to the Lord, you have been telling me, lead these people, but you have not let me know whom you will send with me. You have said, I know you by name and have found favor with me. If you are pleased with me, teach me your way so I may know you and continue to find favor with you. Remember that this nation is your people. We'll stop there for now. Now, I'm sure you can already see there's a lot going on here, and we're not going to be able to fully unpack it all, but we're going to hit some highlights. So what we see here again is God comes to speak to Moses again, apparently in a tent outside of camp known as the Tent of Meeting. Creative name, I know. They were good at naming things. Very descriptive, at least, right? And he says, fine, I won't destroy the people, but I can't go with you either. They are impossible. If I see what they're doing, they're constantly doing, I might destroy them on the way. So instead, God said, I'll send an angel. You'll get the land I promised. I'll even help you get it with the angel, but I can't come along. Now, that is a fascinating interaction that I don't think that we break down all that often. God says, I'm going to send an angel. I'm going to give you the land. But then he also says, I can't go along. So we realize what God is withholding. At least part of the discipline that comes along with having God with. He says, I'll help you get to the land. And then you're going to be on your own. You'll have the land. And you don't need to worry about being accountable to me. That's what he's saying here, right? Again, this is obviously a very confusing interaction. What in the world is going on here? I know I say this a lot, but we're here again. So often, passages like this one are a stumbling block for people. We tend to pull them out of the story and use them as the defining stories to teach us about who God is. God is clearly fickle, moody, violent, right? With the last two stories we look at, that's what it seems like. God says, I'm going to wipe these people off entirely. Moses talks him out of it. He goes, fine. You can have what you want, but I'm not coming with. He seems like a moody teenager in some of these spaces, right? And one with a propensity of violence and the ability to pull it off. That's what it seems like at first glance. But we've spent a year going through the book of Exodus, haven't we, right? And I know you're all sick of hearing this because I say it almost every single week. A major theme of Exodus has been what? A declaration from God that he is not like all the other gods. He said over and over and over and over again, even using the myths of Amun-Ra to say, I know Amun-Ra is like this, I'm not. I know Isis is like this, I'm not. Osiris is like this, that's not me. I know that your experiences with the other gods are like this, I'm not that. That's a humongous theme throughout the book of Exodus. It's a declaration over and over and over and over again in which God is saying, I'm not like the other gods. And then we get to these stories where he looks exactly like the other gods, doesn't he? I'm mad at you, and if you're not careful, lightning bolt from heaven. How many times have I stood here and said, Yahweh's not like Zeus? Well, he sure does look like it in this story, doesn't he? And so we're faced with a choice. We can let this be the defining story of God, who God is, or we can recognize it as what appears to be out of God's character. I would argue that if we've taken Exodus seriously, that's our only option. If that's the case, then, if this story is weird and seemingly out of character, we have to ask ourselves the next question: what is it trying to teach us then? We're faced with the same question we had in the last story. Moses is going to advocate again on behalf of Israel. So who is this declaration for? Is it for God? Does he need to be convinced to keep his covenant, talked out of it? Or is it for Israel to see that what they've done and the severity of it? Is it for Moses to learn something about God again? Now we see in this story, the people do react. They repent, they mourn, which is a good thing. But I want to focus specifically on Moses' interaction. Moses said, "Lord, you've been telling me to lead these people." That's an interesting way to say it, isn't it? "I'm leading, God, because you told me to." He creates this kind of distance there, doesn't he? The last sentence that we read reinforces that. "Remember, God, these are your people, not my people, yours." It's fascinating as well. Moses is creating this kind of distance between him and the people of Israel. "I'm leading them because you told me to. Remember, they're your people. I'm here because you made me be." Right? There's a separation between him and the people. Moses even says, "I appreciate that I've found favor with you, God, and I want to keep learning more about how to live in the way you created us to live." Right? He says, "I love the relationship you and I have, God." But he doesn't say, "Don't destroy them because they're my people," does he? At least not yet. So, to remind us all, God has said, "I will give you the land. I will send an angel to help you get it," which from a worldly perspective, again, is a pretty good deal. You're going to get to have a nation with land, which is great. "I just won't be there," God says. Moses responds to God and says, "I can't accept that. I see your value personally. I need you to stay with me. I can't do this without you." That's what Moses has said. That's where we've gotten to up till now. Everybody tracking? Okay. We got one more thing we got to look at, then we'll pull it all together. And this is what the Lord says. "The Lord replied, 'My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest.'" So essentially, Moses says, "I need you to stay with me." God says, "I got you, Mo." They were close, so I'm assuming he called him Mo, right? I know it doesn't say it in the Bible, but we can probably assume that. "At this point, I can't travel with Israel, but," God says, "you, Moses, my presence will stay with you, and you will have rest." Essentially, they can go do their thing. "I understand you just asked me to stay with you, and so I will, but I still got to stay away from them." Again, another amazing offer. At this point, God has offered Moses the right to start over, be done with these stiff-necked, frustrating Israels. Moses turns that down. Then God offers Moses an angel to get to the land that was promised without the accountability of having to actually follow God, which, if a lot of us were honest, doesn't sound so bad either. Right? Don't let that part slip by too fast. Because I think many Christians take that second deal. Now, you might be thinking, "Okay, Brent, you lost it. I haven't been promised any land to be conquered lately with the help of an angel." Fair. But how many of us have lived, or perhaps are still living, with a different promised land being the only goal? See, we just don't call it Canaan. We call it heaven. For many of us, we just want to get to heaven. It's the only goal. Sit with that for a bit. Are we satisfied with just having the promised land, but not having God's presence with us? Again, not Canaan, heaven. See, in our story, Moses wasn't. He realizes that the presence of God with him is more valuable than the promised land. And so he says, "Keep teaching me how to live the flourishing life." Moses rejects the idea that the promised land is just good enough. He rejects the idea that it's only about the promised land. In other words, he rejects the idea that it's just about heaven. What he realizes is that God's presence is greater than the promised land. And so once again, God makes Moses an offer. Fine, God says, I'll stay with you. This, to me, is the most amazing part of this story, because as we've just seen, God has offered Moses a lot. He's offered him the promised land, staying with him personally, and this is how Moses responds. But then Moses says to him, Exodus 33:15, if your presence does not go with us, do not send us up from here. How will anyone know that you are pleased with me and with your people unless you go with us? What else will distinguish me and your people from all the other people on the face of the earth? This moment is massive. Because what do you notice right away? Moses' language shifts, doesn't it? He had just done saying to God, these are your people that you told me to lead. And here, he says, I need you to come with us. See, Moses has had an identity problem his whole life. I just bumped my notes off my screen. That's not good. Moses has had an identity problem his whole life. Who is he? Is one of the other themes that runs through the entire book of Exodus. We didn't hammer this theme as hard, but we did from God being different than the other gods, but it's there. Who is Moses? That theme runs throughout the entire book. For why? He was raised as an Egyptian. He was raised in the Egyptian royal court. So right off the bat, we ask, is he Egyptian? Is that his identity? Is that who he identifies with? And we know that he struggled with that. While living in the Egyptian court, he realized he was different from the other Egyptians. He still felt a kinship to the Hebrews. So much so that it led him to kill an Egyptian who was mistreating a Hebrew slave. There's clearly an identity conflict there. But then, those same people, the Hebrews, reject him too. Exodus 2:14, the man said, who made you, Moses, ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptians? Or Egyptian? Then Moses was afraid and thought, what I've done must have been known. And from there, he takes off and runs. See, his own people don't see him as their own either. He's not fully Egyptian. He's ethnically Hebrew, but not accepted culturally fully at the beginning of this time there either. And it gets even more complicated from there. Moses then runs and meets and marries Zipporah, whose father was an important priest of Midian. Moses then works for Jethro, his father-in-law, for 40 years living in Midian. 40 years is a long time. It takes a couple sentences in the Bible, but that's a really, really long time. His wife is Midianite. His kids are half Midianite, so is he Midianite? Tough question, right? Moses has lived as a prince of Egypt for 40 years is what most scholars believe. He was a shepherd of Midian for 40 years. So half his life as an Egyptian, half his life as a Midianite shepherd. Now the interesting thing is we're told that Moses dies at 120. Fascinating, right? 40, 80, 120. Interesting. Who is Moses? Is he Egyptian? Is he Midianite? Or is he Hebrew? You can see why this moment is such a big deal for him. Moses could have lived in the promised land. He could have still had God's presence, but Moses realized what good is that for me when there is no us? He said, I need you to be with everyone. I need your presence to come with us as a people, because these are my people. This is who I'm a part of. Many people believe this is where Moses finally settles who he is. I am part of the chosen people of God. I'm an Israelite. I'm Hebrew. And here's where the story goes from there. Exodus 33:17. And the Lord said to Moses, I will do the very thing you've asked, because I am pleased with you and know you by name. Then Moses said, now show me your glory. And the Lord said, I will cause my goodness to pass in front of you, and I will proclaim my name, the Lord, in your presence. I will have mercy on whom I have mercy. I will have compassion on whom I have compassion. But, he said, you cannot see my face, for no one may see it and live. Then the Lord said, there is a place near me where you may stand on a rock. When my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft in the rock and will cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will remove my hand and you will see my back, but my face must not be seen." And he passed in front of Moses, proclaiming, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children and their children for the sin of their parents to the third and fourth generation." Moses bowed to the ground and at once and worshiped. "Lord," he said, "if I have found favor in your eyes, then let the Lord go with us. Although this is a stiff-necked people, forgive our wickedness and our sin, and take us as your inheritance." Then the Lord said, "I am making a covenant with you. Before all your people, I will do wonders never before done in any nation in all the world. The people you live among will see how awesome is that work that I, the Lord, will do for you." All right, we have a ton of concepts out there. Let's see if we can tie them all together and bring them home. Now, imagine this last part of the story in my head. I can almost, I picture it a certain way. I know it's not exactly what the Bible says, but I picture it like this. Moses had to learn some really important lessons throughout these three stories. First, he leans into who God is and what his promises were, and God showed him that he can. God, these are the promises you've made. You need to keep those, and God says, "You're right, I will." And Moses learns that if you lean into those things, that God will keep them. Moses then rejects the idea that the promised land was worth more than the presence of God. He learns that lesson as well. He then realizes and accepted that without the people, his people, as well as God's people, there was still something missing. And so he asks God to stay with us. Now, I love to imagine God getting one of those, like, at this declaration that God's looking at Moses, and when Moses finally says, "I need you to come with all of us," him getting that knowing, sly smile on his face, going like, "Nailed it. You got it." Like kind of that proud papa moment, going like, "That's where we were headed this whole time." Because as soon as Moses says that, the tone changes entirely, doesn't it? And God says, "I'll do exactly what you asked. I see you, Mo. Well done." See, it's at that moment that Moses asks to see God. At the conclusion of those learnings, and God says, "Sure," sort of. Right? He says, "You can't see my face. You can't handle that." There's an inference there that he physically can't handle it. We don't know exactly how that works, but that's it. And so Moses goes back to the top of the mountain where he gets two more tablets. We skipped over that part. And then he sees the back of God, or the place where God's glory had passed, with the true declaration of who God is. He says, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands and forgiving the wickedness of rebellion and sin. It's fascinating. What do we do with all of that? Last week, we said that we need to be constantly auditing or evaluating what we believe. Are we aligned with the heart of God? Is what we believe about who God is true? And is it leading us into the kind of life that he wants us to live? Is what we believe about ourselves true? Is what we believe about those around us true? We have to constantly be asking all of those things. And so that follows up by saying, how do we do that? And that's what this story shows. Moses gives us an example, an extremely beautiful one. Moses humbly approaches God on three separate occasions to advocate for Israel. First, when they can't handle his voice. Second, when they build the golden calf. And third, after God says he can't come with them. Each time God makes a difficult statement, and each time Moses solidifies what he knows to be true about God himself. And so let's close by seeing if we can apply each of those to ourselves. We already see the first thing that he does is he appeals to God himself, the promises that God made. God, you promised Abraham you'd give him the land. You've worked to show both Israel and the world around you that you aren't like other gods, and Moses learns that to be true about God. Zeus doesn't relent when somebody talks to him, but Yahweh does. Amun-Ra doesn't relent when somebody is talking to him or leans into the promises he's made before. They're fickle, and they're willing to change that all the time. Now, I get it. The Bible's a long book with parts of it that are really hard to read, parts that are complicated and confusing and weird, and that can be intimidating, overwhelming. You don't need to understand the whole Bible to have a relationship with God, though. Hear me out on that one. See, faith is not an all-or-nothing thing, meaning it's not something you either have or you don't have. It's presented throughout the entire Bible as a kind of continuum. Jesus talks about weak and strong faith, right? Both of them are faith, but there's a stronger faith and a weaker faith. Paul talks about it as an elementary or mature faith. Far too often, we talk about elementary faith as bad, which isn't true at all. If you're new to this whole Jesus thing, of course your faith is elementary. Why would you expect anything else? And we all need to start there. See, faith begins in an elementary way. There's the belief that there's something or someone bigger than us. Perhaps that's step one. Who is that person? This is where I would encourage you to read through the Gospels and look at the person of Jesus. What does Jesus tell us about who God is? What does he show us about who God is? Don't start with the hard passages. The story we look at today comes at the end of Exodus for a reason. We needed to see all of the different examples in which God has said, I'm not like all these other gods. An easy way to understand that concept is, right, you can't learn calculus if you don't know how to add. Right? They're both math, but without knowing how to add, you can't do calculus at all. You start with addition and subtraction and work your way up. How does that apply here? The challenge is to learn who God is, and what he says about who you are, and what he says about the flourishing life, and then lean into that. Try it out. See if what God says is true. That's what Moses is doing in this first interaction. I know that you made these promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I need you to keep those. God says, I will. He leans into those promises he knows are true. And the challenge for us is to do the same. If you are in an elementary part of your faith, lean into those elementary things that the Bible says over and over and over again that are true. After you've done that, continue to keep growing, and then you can get to the more complex parts. The next thing Moses learns is, I think, a particularly important one for us in the American church. He realizes that while the promised land is good, it is not the good. It is not the end-all, be-all. God offers Moses the promised land without the accountability of having God with them. And so I'll ask the question, why are you in church today? Why come? Is it because you want to get to heaven? I know there was a season in my life where that was true. Now, to be clear, there's nothing wrong with that desire. Moses still wants to get to the promised land. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. But is it the only reason you're here? Is it the only reason for your faith? What God offers Moses is more tempting than we realize, isn't it? If I told you today, you're in heaven. The way has been made for you, no matter what else you do for the rest of your whole life, you're in. Would you still come to church? Would you still worry about faith at all? Realize that's what God offers to Moses. I'll send an angel, but I can't go with you because if I do, you'll experience consequence. So often we approach our faith just like that. It fuels so much about how we even talk about what something like sin is. This is good, this isn't. Why? Because if we don't do the things that are good, God will get mad and we won't get into heaven. See, Moses realized while the promised land is good, while heaven is good, it is not worth going without walking with God. He even says, teach me your ways. Help me understand how you see and how you've created this world to be. I want to know more about that because I see value in that beyond just the promised land. Why would Moses ask that, especially when God is removing the consequences for not doing what he said? I would argue it's because he realizes that what Jesus says thousands of years later is true. Jesus says the thief only comes to steal, kill, and destroy. I have come that you may have life and life to its full. John 10:10. I think we have that on a slide if you want to go one more, Chris. Moses asks to walk with God and have him teach his ways because he realizes the whole point has always been that. I have come that you may have life and life to its full. That our faith life is so much more than just getting to the promised land, whether the promised land is Canaan in the Old Testament or heaven in the New. Now, I don't want to brush over the second part of this either. Jesus did say, I've come that we may have life and life to the full. That's true. Moses realizes that, and you realize what that means then. God is offering Moses the promised land without accountability. Moses doesn't want that, which means, Exodus 34:10, then the Lord said, I am making a covenant with you before all your people. I will do wonders never before done in any nation in the world. The people you live among will see how awesome the work that I, the Lord your God, the Lord will do for you. Obey what I command you today. Moses realizes that turning down the offer, you may have the promised land without the accountability, would be easier in some ways. And so by saying he doesn't want that, what he is accepting then is that accountability. If I'm going to accept that you are with me, then I also accept that I'll be held accountable to what you've asked me to do. In other words, if we want to experience the fullness of life God offers, there is an accountability that comes with that. We are required to do hard things. Three different times today, Moses was offered an easier way. Starting over would have been easier than fixing the people who are stubborn. Promised land without accountability would be easier than having accountability. Moses only having to worry about his own faith would have been easier than having to worry about the collective faith of Israel. And yet, Moses realizes with humility that the best way isn't the easiest way. It's actually the far harder one. In order to truly follow God and experience the fullness God promised, Moses needed to self-sacrifice, to put himself aside. He puts his comfort and relative safety aside. Moses is going to experience hardship. He wouldn't have to because he chose to stay with the group. There are times where Israel as a collective whole experiences consequences because some of them don't do what they're supposed to do. So we get that twisted sometimes, don't we? For us to experience the fullness that God is offering, we're going to have to step into places that are uncomfortable, jarring. We're going to have to humbly self-sacrifice at times into places that will cost us. Sometimes it'll cost us financially. To care for the poor, we're going to have to give up what we have for their sake. And perhaps they might even misuse it. Okay? We're going to have to work and advocate for systems that help those who don't deserve it sometimes in our minds. We're going to have to get our hands dirty. That comes with the territory. Sometimes it'll cost us socially. If we're going to care for the marginalized, we're going to need to understand the stories of the people the church has historically rejected. That's what Jesus does. What are you doing with those people? The Pharisees are constantly asking Jesus. You're with the sinners and the tax collectors, with people that we've rejected from society, and Jesus says, yep, that's where I got to go. He asks us to do the same. We need to hear the stories of the people the church has historically marginalized or rejected. And that's going to make some of us uncomfortable. Because what it would require is you have to hear the story of the gay, the lesbian, the transgender person. What's their story? Because how can we help anyone if we don't know them? If that's a place you've never been, that comes with the territory. To step in, to listen to what their stories are, what their reality is, how they experience the world, so that you can truly love them for who they are. You're going to have to listen to the story of the immigrant, legal or otherwise. How do we advocate, help, support if we don't know who they are? If there's some kind of abstract idea out in the space and we don't know the personal stories they're wrestling with, there's nothing we can do to help because we don't know who they are. They're just an idea. That's uncomfortable. It's jarring. It's paradigm shifting. And it's the accountability that comes with us if we say we actually don't just want heaven, we want to walk with God. We have to step up next to the addicted or to the abuser, to all of those, not to justify or condone what they've done, but to understand where they're coming from, why, what hurt drives them, so we can offer whatever help we can. It will cost us. Sometimes it'll cost us emotionally. As much as we want the world to be simple, this is good and this is bad, these people are good and these are the bad ones, it's just not that. It's not. I'm sorry. It is so much easier to just declare who's in and who's out. This is good, this is bad. It is way harder to step into the mess. Because when we do, we realize that nothing is simple. In other people's lives, the more you start to peel back the layers of why someone does something, you realize, holy cow, that story is twisted, intertwined. Not always twisted, you know what I mean? Intertwined. There's so many different factors that play into those things. And the fact of the matter is, if we really start to step into that mess, we realize that's true for our own lives as well. That there are so many assumptions and blind spots that we have ourselves, which is why stepping into other people's mess is so difficult, because often it shines the light back on ourselves, and we realize that we have places in our lives we haven't dealt with either. See, we're predisposed to looking first outward at what everyone else is doing wrong or has messed up. But if we're truly going to follow God, He doesn't allow that. He often calls us to look inward into our own hearts. And that isn't easy. I'll be vulnerable here. Each time I do that, every single time I've taken an intentional look back inward on myself, it is always uglier than I hoped it would be. See, I have this bad habit of every time I do some work on myself, I can fall into the temptation that now I've arrived. Because I tell myself, I'm so much better than I used to be, which actually is true, and that's the temptation. But then I pull back another layer and realize there's still pettiness or selfishness or prejudice or indifference that I hoped and wished wasn't there. But when I honestly look, it is. And so I have to work through it all over again, which is humbling, frustrating, always produces life in the end, but not easy. See, if you're just here to get to heaven, you can avoid all that. Because like what was offered to Moses, the path to the promised land is open. It just requires you to accept the one who goes before you. For Moses, it was an angel. For us, it's Jesus. But I will put this out there. Why does Christianity in America look so messed up? I think it's because a whole bunch of us took the deal that Moses turned down. I think a whole bunch of us decided it would be easier to live with all that accountability without having to step into any of that messiness because the only goal was heaven in the first place. I'm just gonna let that sit. Feels gross, doesn't it? Finally, and we'll go quickly, Moses realizes that the full journey is done with his people. He identifies that we're on a journey together. That in order for us to get through any of this, in order for us to experience any of that fullness of life that God offers us, we need each other. I know we say it all the time, and it can get trite in that space, but it is so desperately true. If we're not going to take the second offer that God gives to Moses to get to the promised land without the accountability, we just talked about all the ways that that will cost us, and those are extremely difficult. They feel weighty. They feel overwhelming. They feel tough. I get it, which is why God says you can't do it by yourself, because there are times when you wade into those spaces. And if you believe in a world in which there's actually an enemy who then tries to convince you that when you pulled that back and I saw prejudice again, Brent, you're a fraud. Sometimes I need someone like Kyle to go, no, you're not, man. We all have that. Right? I need Mike to give me encouragement when he comes up and does that all the time. Like, I need those things. I won't make it otherwise. Neither will you. It's what Moses realizes as well, that I need God with me, sure, but it doesn't work without us. That's how this thing works, because if we're actually going to do the hard work and take the accountability that comes with accepting God with us, it isn't easy. It's incredibly hard, and that's why we carry each other's burdens. That's why we encourage each other, or as Paul says, spur one another on towards the goal. Because that's the only way it works. Paul says it this way, and this is a passage we read all the time, every time we do communion. He says here, there is no Gentile or Jew, circumcised or uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave or free, but Christ is all and is in all. Therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. Bear with each other and forgive one another if any of you has a grievance against someone. Forgive as the Lord forgave you, and over all these virtues put on love, which binds them all together in perfect unity. Let the peace of Christ rule in your heart, since members of one body you were called to peace, and be thankful. The story is a confusing one with lots of parts in which it seems like we have to wrestle with who God is. I hope you've been able to see as we work through this that I truly believe that in each of these interactions, God is teaching Moses something critically important about who he is and about how he understands what the heart of God is. Begins by saying, the promises I've made to you are true. And I'll be faithful to those. I'm not like Zeus or Amun-Ra. He's actually saying that exactly the opposite. Second, he's saying that the life that I want for you is so much more than just the promised land. That is part of it. We're going there. That's important. That's great. You can look forward to that. And me being with you is greater than that. Same is true for us. And third, that in that walking with me, there's both flourishing but accountability as well, which is hard, and so you need each other. Moses finally finds his identity as one of the people of God, which in the Old Testament is Israel, and in the New Testament is the church. That realize we're all on this journey together, that we've all accepted the path towards the flourishing life God's offer, and then we've also then accepted the accountability that comes with it. And so we work together to continue to spur each other on towards that, to step into those messy places, to hear the stories of those who are different than us, who are marginalized or hurting, to do it even at self-sacrificial cost. Because that's how the world changes. That's how it becomes more like the kingdom than it does like everything else around it. Moses needed to learn that as the leader of Israel. We need to learn that as part of the church. It's a beautiful story of God's promises on display. God's promises on display, teaching Moses that he isn't like all the other gods around, and instead leads us into something so much greater than that. So that's the challenge that we have today. Is to try to learn the same lessons Moses had. To start our journey by understanding who God is and lean into those promises, whether they're elementary or mature. Is to evaluate why we're doing this faith thing in the first place. Is it just to get to heaven, or do we think there's something greater? Do we want God to teach us his ways so we can move into the flourishing life he offers? And realizing that comes with sacrifice as well and accountability, are we willing to do it together? And so I challenge you all to just evaluate that for yourself and see where God leads. Because I think that if we do that well, this place starts to look a lot more like heaven than hell. And the world will take notice, just like it was supposed to take notice of Israel. And we can be an influence of good and change in this world. Will you pray with me? Heavenly Father, Lord, we realize that for many of us, we need to learn the lessons that Moses learned. Whether it's starting with just understanding who you are, to really take an evaluation of what we believe about you and what your character is. God, for those of us who are in that place, God, I pray that you give us clarity on where to start. Give us confidence in those promises that are unmovable, that we can lean into and experience as true. Also, God, for those of us who have lived our lives only desiring the promised land rather than the relationship with you, Lord, first we just pray for forgiveness for that. And then second, give us the courage to be willing to step into something that might be harder but will be far greater in the end. Help us to understand where the next step in our relationship with you is so that we can take those steps towards flourishing. And then finally, Lord, may we support, care, and spur each other on. So that when we get to the hard places in which we have to wrestle with difficult things, whether it's internally as we look at our own junk, or whether it's stepping into the uncomfortable places of this world with people who are different from us, who see the world different from us, who experience things different than us. We hear their stories, and even though we might be uncomfortable, we can see them through your eyes. Give us your wisdom and your direction. Amen.